Hi, I'm Mike Nagrant, and you're listening to Hunger Magazine from Chicago, Illinois.
4, 3, 2.
One more time.
Hi there, it's been a month since I last brought you a podcast, but this week's edition is a real treat. I sit down with Chef Grant Ackett of Alinea Restaurant here in Chicago. For those of you who haven't heard about Alinea, it was recently named the number one restaurant in America by Gourmet Magazine. Chef Ackett and his partner Nick Kokonis are reimagining what it means to dine in America. Ackett's has been lumped in as a molecular gastronomist, and it's true his food, which might include frozen olive oil crackers, swinging bacon with butterscotch, or dehydrated powders, does have a techno bent. But his whimsy is almost always in service to the locally grown farm-raised pristine product he uses. He pursues a purity of taste over theater. Ackett's hasn't stopped at the food either. He's formed a partnership with Martin Kastner of Crucial Detail, and together they've invented a whole line of serveware pieces that reimagines the plate and silverware in general. In many cases, they do away with the plate altogether. Enjoy the interview.
So what did you have for breakfast this morning?
I had, and this is a rarity, because I normally never eat breakfast, but for some reason today I woke up very hungry. I had a matsutake and black pepper omelet.
Which is funny, because the thing I was thinking about on the way over here was Andre Sultner.
Mm-hmm.
He had this sort of maxim of, he would hire a chef, he would ask them to make him an omelet, because he thought he could learn everything about a chef by how he made an omelet.
Right.
And I wonder, I guess it still holds true for what you're doing, or maybe not. You know, I wonder how what you think about that, you know, and maybe even how you would approach an omelet.
Well, I don't think that's particularly true, but I think, I guess if you watch somebody prepare an omelet, you might be able to garner some insight into their ability and their personality. But, you know, I'm sure if he would have watched me make an omelet, he would have been appalled. And I'm not so sure that speaks directly to my cooking ability, so I don't know.
Yeah, I saw your recipe you had in Gourmet.
Uh-huh.
With the asparagus.
Right.
And I thought very much about how the egg drops.
Right.
into the water, and I was like, that's probably how you might make an
right.
omelet.
Right. Right. So yeah, I guess that's my version of an asparagus omelet. Right. Yeah.
You know, you did the Wired magazine article a little mm-hmm. while ago, and one of the things I really liked was this idea of how you added the UltraTex 3
uh-huh.
to your what would normally be like an oil emulsion sauce, and the idea is that the UltraTex doesn't add any flavor, it just adds the texture and the viscosity, and there's sort of this purity to getting at flavors,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I understood that, and I understand most of your cooking, I love it, and, you know, but at the same time, you know, I ate here a year ago, actually,
uh-huh.
In September 30th, so it's almost a year.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, and there was one course for me, which was the, I think it was the black cod with, you had the dehydrated powders.
Yep. The brown butter and the part, yep.
Yeah,
yep.
And that was one, you know, I was just trying to think about, and I was trying to think about why that is a better or a good presentation of that dish,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, why that's a better manifestation. So, like, I understand, you know, like the oil thing, that makes sense to me, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, what are you trying to get at there, or what do you think, you know, you're doing with the diner there?
Well, you're doing things that go beyond flavor, and I think that's something that people either do or don't understand, you know, and the naysayers of this style of cuisine will always point fingers and say, why manipulate? And you manipulate for a lot of different reasons. You manipulate to enhance flavor, you manipulate to enhance or change or alter texture, to become the end-all to a very definitive vision for presentation. And I think all of those things collide into a style. So in this particular case where we're talking about a dish prepared in a more modern interpretation of a very classic fish preparation, you know, if you dry a lemon and parsley and capers and brown butter, not only are you intensifying flavor by removing moisture, but you're also, altering the experience that the guest perceives, and the guest kind of, when they're presented with a piece of fish with powders and told that, you know, this is brown butter, lemon, and capers, you know, there's an element there, there's an emotional element there that we try to trigger that is pretty important to the cuisine. And while all the food should taste delicious, you know, that should be, for the most part, a given. I would hope that any restaurant you go to, the food's delicious. If it's not, then there's an issue with that particular dish or with that particular restaurant. So as we try to delve into different realms of, you know, texture and presentation and flavor layering and things like that, then that's where these dishes come from.
I guess that worked in some sense, because the thing I said it reminded me of was like a savory like a maid, like where you dip the sticks.
Or dipping sticks, right.
But the cod itself was like the dipping stick.
Right,
I suppose that works. You know, another thing I think you've said is this idea that, or maybe people have said that you said, is this idea of you perfect a dish and then you like to replace it. And I wondered if that is the central idea, or the idea I thought about was like, you know, if you're, like, say you're Picasso or whatever, and, you know, those guys don't necessarily replace their paintings. Their paintings still exist. You know, like something like Guernica, which was created, you know, mid-career, is still exists, and it's still there for people to enjoy. He just kept going, you know, and I wonder if that's the real central idea. I mean, you know, why don't, I know you don't want to serve the same thing over like a black truffle, because then possibility exists that you don't go beyond the black truffle, but I think if you recognize that, you know, you want to go beyond it, that it's still something that maybe people should enjoy, like they should a good piece of art, I don't know.
Well, there's a lot of things here that come to play too, and you hit on a couple of them. One is, you know, that Victor Parsemore is going to exist forever. The meal that I cook tonight for you, if you were to come here and eat tonight, as soon as you eat it, it's gone. Now, tomorrow I may replicate it, or an hour later we might serve the same dish to that table, but it's never the same, ever. If we cook it 14 times, it's going to be different 14 times. He paints it once, it's the same that way forever. And that's one aspect of it. The other aspect is, the minute, like you said, the minute we say, okay, this dish is going to stay on forever. This is our oysters and pearls. This is our whatever signature dish from, you know, name your chef. Then, yeah, we run the risk of stopping. And while someday that might become comforting when I get old and tired, right now it's just, you know, I can't conceive of it. And somebody says, well, you know, geez, that black truffle explosion brought me so much pleasure that it's a disservice that you're providing me by not allowing me to have it the next time I come in. Maybe, if you look at it like that, but really, I think if you really understand what we do and how we cook, then you should be excited to discover the next black truffle explosion. And I'm starting to ease back on that philosophy a little bit, because now I'm feeling like, yeah, maybe you got to take two steps back to take a step forward, especially where we are right now, where we're becoming a victim of our own success, and that we're getting so busy, especially with this, you know, this gourmet push recently, that it's making it very difficult to find the time to create. You know, and, you know, you do. You know, you do 80 people a night, every night, and then you feed those 80 people anywhere between 14 and 25 courses, and, you know, it's just the production, the workload is so intense that you find yourself here at 3:30 in the morning, you know, on 4 hours of sleep going, okay, now I gotta come up with a new dish for tomorrow. And it's just like, you can't even see, you know? And it's just like, wow, maybe I need to just take a breath, keep that black truffle explosion on for another week, give myself a day off to really immerse myself in it and come up with the next dish. And so now we're starting to do that a little bit. In fact, the black truffle explosion is on the menu tonight for that very reason, because this morning I had 10 kilos of the most pristine golden trout roe that exists in the world delivered to the restaurant from a good friend of mine who produces it by hand, and he cures it in Vittel water and French salt, sea salt, and it's this artisan product that he only produces a small amount of, out of a place in Michigan where he gets the golden brook trout.
Did you have this on the menu last fall?
Probably,
fall?
Yeah. I think I had probably it. With the pineapple.
Yeah,
and, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, so every year he produces this wonderful stuff, and it's such a small quantity that I tell him I'll take as much as you can bear to give me. And so this morning, 10 kilos show up at the back door, and that's a lot of roe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so now I'm just like, holy cow, I gotta come up with a dish, because now I got $7,000 worth of caviar sitting in my refrigerator right now that I gotta come up with something really nice for it. So, you know, that's today's project. So now by putting that black truffle on, in a way it's a crutch, but it's a darn good crutch to have, because sure. I know that anybody that gets it tonight's gonna be happy. So it's a juggling act, you know.
Is this the first time you've done it since Trio, or no?
We brought it a little bit. We brought it back last fall for white truffles for a couple of people, and then we had it on for like a week, but that was about it. Mm-hmm. You know, it just becomes this balancing act between your ambitions and goals and who you are as a person, as an artist, and then as somebody that is a service provider, as somebody that's a restaurateur, as somebody that's a business person, as somebody that wants to provide the best possible experience for their guests, you know? It's kind of a tough line.
It seems like the summer before you guys opened here, you had sort of a tasting lab mm-hmm. set up, and, you know, you did the e-gullet
yep.
conversation about that, and I would imagine that was a very productive time for you, and you know, I wonder, you know, I guess Ferran Adria they close down El Bulli in the summer, and they go to the lab, and is that a practical reality? Is that something you can do? Is that something you would want to do to give yourself that time?
Definitely something I'd want to do. Probably not a practical reality here in the United States. Mm-hmm. I think the economics that come into play in those European situations are a little bit different than what we have here. And you have to remember, too, that El Bulli's been there for 20 years. You know, we're a year and a half old. Still have a lot of bills to pay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wouldn't really do anybody any good if we shut for a half a year and then went out of business, because obviously
right.
there wouldn't be much food to serve at that point. But yeah, and then if you say, okay, well that's not a realistic possibility, then you start questioning your standing as a chef and what my priorities are as a chef. Well, should I be the guy back there cleaning 30 pounds of matsutake mushrooms because I'm trying to lead by example and trying to set the tone for the kitchen? That's how Thomas was. That's how I was brought up in the kitchen. He would be the guy that would, you know, grab the broom and sweep the floor and bang out a couple pots and then come back to the cutting board and, you know, start butchering fish. And as a young cook, you look up to that and you aspire to it and you think, wow, what a great leader, what a great mentor. And then conversely, you go to El Bulli and you see Ferran sitting at a desk in the kitchen, never touching any food. He's got a couple of books, a notebook pad, a glass of water. And he sits there for 12 hours just jotting notes down. And now, you know, obviously he's had the most creative restaurant in the country for, you know, I don't know, 7, 8, 10 years, because he's a great delegator. And he doesn't have to be standing there cleaning the mushrooms. He can be sitting back coming up with brilliant ideas. So, you know, that's an internal struggle that I have when we talk about constantly evolving and pushing the boundaries. That takes time and energy, you know, it really does. And so, you know, trying to find that balance again is difficult.
Yeah, I mean, you're already working till 1 or 2 in the morning just
serving.
Yeah,
3 or 4
right?
in the morning, yeah. Well, yeah, just serving it, right. Like last night, I think we put out the last plate at like 1:45.
Yeah.
You know, then you got to clean up. Then you got to place the orders.
Yeah.
And then you got to start creating. So it's a tough road.
Which, you know, I guess it's a testament that you've been able to create as well as you have. I mean, you know, I think so many people use that as a crutch, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like, oh, I can't, I don't have time. And,
right.
You know, and you alluded to the gourmet factor, you know, and you guys were named number one recently. Does that change the dining audience at all? I mean,
yeah.
I would think that the people who read gourmet would already be coming here, but I don't know, you know.
No, it changes it, I would say, pretty dramatically. And you see this whenever you get very mainstream press. You know, there's a segment of people that simply don't know, there's a large segment of people that simply didn't or don't know that Alinea even exists, despite the mountain suppressant we've received, because a lot of it is very foodie specific. We've gotten so much internet play off of all the food blogs that obviously the people that read the food blogs, they're hardcore foodies, so when they come here, it's a totally different clientele than if we get our first 4-star review in the Tribune, or if we get, you know, we're on the Today Show, and, you know, we blanket 3 million people. You're going to get a different type of person. You're going to get the type of person that's sitting in their living room watching the Today Show that has never even heard of us and said, oh my goodness, that looks interesting. Like, let's give them a call and go there for dinner tonight. And so, yeah, there's a huge wave of different patterns of people that come in based on, you know, what hits. It's like when Wired hit, naturally you get a lot of techies and a lot of, you know, so it's just it's an interesting to follow that. It's a very interesting pattern. It's fun.
So I think with like the Today Show, you get somebody who clearly they care about food because it's a commitment if they're not in Chicago, especially mm-hmm. to come. But maybe they're not a hardcore foodie. And so I guess they'll be surprised, maybe, or they'll be, you know, and that either means delight or confusion.
Right.
You know, and I think maybe there's more confusion. You know, do you guys find that you have more conversations with those diners, or, you know?
You find that you, upon the reservation-taking process, you know, it's very...
You manage expectations.
yeah. I mean, our reservationists are pretty savvy at one, spotting the diner that really has no idea what we're about, and then two, trying to really gently coach them into understanding the experience to make sure that they still want to come. You know, you'll get a lot of questions on the phone after the Today Show hit, like that people will be calling up to make a reservation, and we're pretty thorough upon the reservation taking process, explaining that it's 2 tasting menus, this is the amount of time you should expect to spend at the restaurant, and people are just like, oh, well, you know, can I get a salad? And, you know, so, you know.
A frozen salad.
Right, maybe a frozen salad. So you need to coach them, and you need to make sure that they understand kind of what they're getting into. But one of the, you know, biggest victories for us is having that person come in that's not a hardcore loyalist and foodie and not really knowing what to expect and sit down and just be, like, totally surprised and blown away. Like, that's a very rewarding experience, too, so. It doesn't, you know, this is a, while it is very foodie driven, this is also a very emotionally rich experience. So it should be something that every person can enjoy, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you started out with the PB&J.
Right.
What's more emblematic of anybody's childhood than
right.
that, right?
Right, exactly.
With the PB&J, I think I had read something about how you guys were eating a lot of grapes at family meal because, mm-hmm. you know, you were trying to peel them on the stem. And
wow.
I wondered about family meals even at a place like this. Is that different than what you would normally, you know, get if you were at a traditional restaurant or what you've grown up with in family meal?
I think so. Yeah, I think we made a very conscious effort in the beginning to try to take that block of time in our day and make it as much as a family meal, quote unquote, should be or would be or could be by, one, prioritizing the actual food. We said, you know, a lot of restaurants, you know, you get busy and you don't have time and you just kind of sling something out. We actually integrate it into our prep day and say, we're going to make some, you know, this is what we're doing tomorrow. Not like show up that day and be like, oh my God, staff meal in an hour. What am I going to put together? It's like we know the day prior, we order for it, everybody gets it on their prep list. And then I think equally uncommon is that the entire staff sits down together, physically sits down in the kitchen. We're fortunate enough to have, you know, those 2 long mm-hmm. islands there that we can basically, 20 people on each island can just surround. We bring up some stools that we bought from IKEA. And everybody sits down together, and we have a really nice meal, and everybody is, it's required to sit. We don't let anybody get up and prep, despite how in the weeds they are. And I think it's very productive. It gives everybody a peace of mind. It gives a sense of family. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's really nice.
What kind of things have you guys been eating?
We eat, it's very ethnically driven. Mm-hmm. Yesterday we had Potbellies.
Did you?
Yeah, they were nice enough to send over an entire staff meal, sandwiches of all different kinds and chips and cookies and all that stuff. And congratulations for the gourmet thing.
Nice.
Yeah, it was very nice. But normally it's like, you know,
what's your preferred potbelly sandwich?
You know, I'm a ham and Swiss guy now.
Okay.
I switched from a wreck not too long ago.
Yeah, I'm a wreck guy.
A lot of really nice pastas, good tacos on Sundays always, you know, really ethnic tacos, not Americanized tacos. But
and if things don't go well, you might have a lot of roe in the future.
Or if they don't go well, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, the staff meals are really great.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wondered because, you know, that's the thing about it, you know, much is made about with this restaurant, how, you know, you've not only changed the food, but you've changed the dining experience, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's the lighting or the way you serve wine. And
uh-huh.
So, yeah, it seems that, you know, I would guess you take it into the kitchen as well.
We try as much as we can, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you spoke a little bit about Thomas, mm-hmm. your time at the French Laundry with Thomas Keller. One of the things I'm kind of interested in is you also, I know you spent a little bit of time with Charlie Trotter, not uh-huh. as much certainly as Thomas. You know, and the Trotter experience, I don't think, worked for you maybe as well. And one of the things that I thought was interesting was how your sous chef and your chef de cuisine both spent time at Trotter's,
uh-huh.
at least what I read.
Right.
And so, obviously, there's still a value in that experience, or there's a value in what's going on there. And so, you know, I wonder maybe why the Trotter experience didn't work out for you, or if it did, maybe it didn't, or... you know, how they compare and contrast even in terms of the approaches.
Right. They're certainly both valuable because they're certainly two of the best restaurants in the world. And how they've achieved that status is probably through different means of personality, but management and cuisine style. You know, the French Laundry, I always equate it to like a relationship. You can have several different significant others throughout the course of your life, and then maybe you find the right one. And that has, there's a large dynamic there. And I think the coworkers, the people that you're spending 16 hours a day with, what are they like? What is the management style like? What is the, you know, what are the hours like? Where do you live? You know, is it Napa or is it Chicago? And, you know, how old are you? Like, when I was at Trotter's, I was just out of culinary school. I was 22 years old. I was as green can be, you know? Didn't really know what to expect. And so I think a lot of that had come into play with my, kind of my short stay at his restaurant. But I think they were equally important to me personally because I got a lot out of that Trotter experience and I continue to get a lot out of it. You gotta admire the fact that that restaurant's been open 20 years. It's unbelievable. And I just did an event there to celebrate the 19th anniversary of his restaurant back in June or July. You know, you walk back in those doors and it's just, you realize that they've been pushing since day one and they're still pushing. And it's really admirable. Now Thomas, you know, he's the guy. I mean, he's my mentor and he taught me how to cook, taught me work ethic, taught me a lot. I mean, he was really instrumental in my career, not only just from the cooking side, but also just kind of how to live and you know, just a really, really integral, generous person. Mm-hmm. But the atmosphere in that kitchen was a lot different. I would say by nature in Trotter's kitchen at the time that I was there, which was 1995, it was a very competitive environment. And while it was competitive at the French Laundry, there was more a sense of teamwork, I would feel. But again, it's just a personal thing. Mm-hmm. You know, you just click with certain people in certain restaurants, and I just really clicked with him and that atmosphere. So that's ultimately what led to my staying there for 4 years.
I think, you know, when you think about the French Laundry, you know, of course you think about the craft and the dedication and the purity of ingredients. And, you know, of course Thomas is a whimsical guy as well. I mean, you know, whether it's the oysters and pearls or it's the peas and carrots, those
right.
kind of things. But what you're doing is sort of, I don't know, to borrow a term from evolution, like a punctuated equilibrium, it's different. It's, mm-hmm. you know, it's separate and apart from that. And the easy thing is to just look at your influences and go, well, how did you would expect that you would be doing just sort of a step above that as opposed to where you've gone. Mm-hmm. And I wonder where your style came from. You know, when you were, was there a moment while you were in Thomas's kitchen doing stuff that, you know, like this, and, you know, and going, hey, should we do this here? Or, you know, how did that happen? How did, where did that evolution come from?
Well, I think it, stuff like that's always present within you. Even when I was working at my father's restaurant when I was 12 years old, I wanted to push it, you know. We're talking about meatloaf and mashed potatoes, and I was always trying to come up with a way to make it a little bit different. So I think that seed existed even then. It definitely started to come to be more prolifically at the French Laundry. And Thomas was always very generous with allowing me to contribute my ideas. But there were times when he would be like, this is the French Laundry. Like, you know, we just can't take that step. It's beyond our identity, mm-hmm. you know, in which I respected and understood. And finally, it got to a point after I had been sous chef there for 2 years. And during that time, you know, he had given me a lot of responsibility. So I was really becoming comfortable running a kitchen and came to realize that, you know, when it was time to come up with new things, I felt like I was increasingly wanting to go outside of this box that the French Laundry was in. And so that's ultimately what led to me deciding to leave and take the spot at Trio. Mm-hmm. So I knew I could try to define my own style as a chef.
Would you audition for the job at Trio? You cooked the Black Truffle Explosion, is that right?
I did.
Do you remember how that, the genesis of that idea, like how you, yep. when it came and how it, mm-hmm. I'm curious.
I was taking duck confit out of a sous vide bag at the French Laundry and had out of the refrigerator. And the juices that had come from the duck legs were congealed in the bag. And when I opened the bag, I was taking all the gelée off the leg. And as I was doing so, the gelée was melting in my hand. And I don't know, it just something clicked. I was just looking at it going, oh, it's touching my body and it's melting. Like, and this happens all the time in cooking. It's not like it's uncommon, but for some reason that clicked to the point where I was like, it's a solid, now it's a liquid. Like, hey, this is cool. And it just so happened that somebody at the same time was rolling in yolote. So the pasta machine was out and the dough was there. So I took a little chunk of the duck gelée and sandwiched it between two pieces of pasta and threw it in the water. And sure enough, that solid turned into a liquid. And I just said, this could be cool. And so this was probably a month prior to me going to Evanston and trying out with Henry. And I said, well, let's try this. Let's try adding some gelatin to some truffle juice and see if we can make a big impact, you know, with one bite. And yeah, that was definitely one of the things that sealed the deal for me up there. He was, you know, I remember specifically putting it down in front of him and me saying, he was like, what? That's liquid in there? And I was like, yeah, make sure you take it one bite, you know.
Yeah.
And just the smile that came over his face when he took that bite, I pretty much knew that I think this job's going to be mine if I want it, you know.
Nice.
Yeah.
You talked about your father a little bit. I think one of the other things I had read was that he had kind of warned you against this career and said that this was not conducive to a normal family life.
Right.
You know, I sat down with Jerry Kleiner yesterday, you know, Marche, Red Light, all those places, and, you know, he was talking about how he struggled for a really long time between his 20s and his 30s trying to figure out what he wanted to do, and, you know, because you just don't think, oh, I can go into the restaurant industry or I can do that, and, you know, we were talking about how we're just fascinated by people who kind of know. And the thing is, if you look at the way you did it, I mean, you went to CIA, you know, as soon as you graduated, and then, you know, you went to, you know, some of the greatest restaurants in the world, and you worked your way through, and it just seems like the most natural progression. You were committed to it so early on.
Right.
And it just, you wonder how people find that direction so early, or how you did, and how you knew.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that you really, really know. I mean, I know that at one point when I was a senior in high school, had a very distinct fork in the road moment where I said, okay, it's going to be either cooking or like architectural design. And I had to, it was getting to the point where if I was actually going to apply to some of these colleges to go into architecture or to go into drafting, that I needed to pull the trigger and start filling out some applications. And I just said, nah, I'm going to cook, you know. And because academics weren't, you know, I was a very average high school student, didn't really apply myself unless it was something artistically driven. And I just said, yeah, I think, you know, I think this cooking thing is where it's at for me. But more than that, I think once you make that decision, it was just like, whatever it would have been, I think, if I would have said, I'm going to go into architecture, I'm going to go into civil engineering or something, I think the same intensity would have been applied to whatever path. I think that's just a personal trait, you know. And so for me, as a you know, 18-year-old, 19-year-old, whatever, to put my head down and go to culinary school and, you know, not party and do what all my college friends were doing, it was just, that's just a personal thing, you know. And so I got on the accelerated program really quickly, and here we are, you know.
One of the diversions you took was you worked as a winemaker, or you worked as a winemaker's assistant in uh-huh. California. I don't know that I've ever read or heard much about that experience with you. You know, obviously it probably plays a role in how you approach your food, but I'm curious what you kind of got out of that, or how you use that today.
Yeah, it was a great experience. In fact, I was just telling a story to one of the cooks about 45 minutes ago, because we're sitting there picking Concord grapes off the stem. Really small winery, really fantastic gentleman by the name of Bill Smith that owned it. And, you know, we're talking about 5,000 case production annually, so really small. There was only four or five employees of the winery. So it was super hands-on. You know, when I first went to Napa, I was so naive about the amount of hours I was going to be working at the French Laundry that I told myself, oh, while I'm in Napa, I should try to work at a winery while I'm cooking. That didn't happen. So then when I came to the point where I said, you know, I really want to do this wine thing while I'm here in the valley. And so I got lucky to get hooked up with Bill at La Jota Vineyard Company. And it really developed my palate. It gave me a greater appreciation for wine itself. It, you know, one of the things is that up until that point, I fell into the common trap of wine as trophies. And while I was educated in wine and took courses in it in culinary school and had a respect for it as a chef and a restaurant person, I always looked at labels and prestige and all that stuff guiding me through the quality.
Sure.
But Bill was just like the guy that would, you know, one of the first days that I worked at the winery, we got done and they were cooking dinner out on the campfire, and it was just like peasant food. And he runs inside and grabs, like, I don't know what it was. It was like a bottle of 1984 Dunn Cabernet in Magnum, which was probably God knows how much money. I don't know, $800-900 or something like that. And just pulls a cork out and starts pouring it into plastic cups for everybody, you know. There was like four or five of us standing there. And I was looking at him incredulous, and he was just like, it's just grape juice, you know. And it was great. It was such a great thing because, and he was right, as a winemaker, you don't get caught up in all that. Right. Because you see the grapes growing, you pull them off, you know, you crush them, it's grape juice, man. You
it
know?
Wasn't a $900 bottle to you, it was the same amount of labor.
And right. So it was pretty cool. And, you know, you really tune into your palate, tasting wines every day, and what, following the progress of a wine as it matures in the barrel. Because literally, you would take the wine thief down there and you would taste a splash every day, and you could see it, you know, arc and flavor. And so I think that really develops your palate.
Right.
But, you know, I understood after 9 months that I needed to cook to be happy. As much as I loved, you know, working for him and at that particular place and that time in my life, it just wasn't, there was no gratification. So I needed to go back.
It's funny, the wine is almost like your cuisine in that sense, in that each day it's different.
I mean, yep.
The bottle of wine is never the same after the next day.
Right.
You know, I was thinking about, again, this idea of you know, innovating. You know, much has been made, and there's been resistance to what you do in some circles. And I know you didn't live 30 years ago, but do you have any sense of that what you're up against now is similar to, you know, what was going on with Nouvelle Cuisine in the early 70s when the Trogwa brothers and Paul Bocuse and these guys were doing that. I mean, it seems like they had a really tough row to hoe there, or, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, now that's de rigueur. It's what we do, you know?
I think it's all the same.
Yeah.
You know, I try to explain to people that it's a 15 to 20 year cycle and you can chase it all the way back. You know, I remember reading things about Charlie back in like 89, 90. I think there was a piece in the New York Times Magazine written by Molly O'Neill where it talked about how he was a reckless fusionist that had, on any given plate, could have Japanese ingredients mixed with French and Thai and American, you know, and how radically, you know, innovative that was and how risk-taking it was. And, you know, the same thing with Thomas. And so you take that generation 15 years ago, and then you spin it back another step, and you see the innovators and the visionaries that taught Thomas and Charlie, you know, and so it goes back in blocks. Certainly. I mean, I think people are a little bit more up in arms about what we're doing right now because it involves a particular level of science, and they feel a strong disconnect between the humanity or the kind of the emotional side of and the comfort side of what cooking should be or what has been provided to them with the test tube and the microscope. But, you know, it's like I say, it's people, you know, what is this, you know, tapioca maltodextrin? I say, well, what is sodium bicarbonate? What is calcium chloride? You know, it's tapioca, man. It's a root that grows in the ground. Like, don't get all freaked out about it. It's the same thing.
Is that part of the reason you don't like the molecular gastronomy label, because it alienates diners from what you're doing? Or, you know,
to me, molecular gastronomy is a cuisine based on science. What we do is not a cuisine based on science. We use science, but it's not the starting point or the ending point. You know, I think there are molecular gastronomists that are practicing today, and I think they enjoy that particular niche that they've found and created. But that's just not what we do. It's, you know.
Would you say like Wiley DeFrance? Yes. I wonder where that line is.
I would definitely say Omaro. I mean, he'll flat out tell you that if he wasn't a cook, he'd be a scientist or, you know, something like that, a designer. And he enjoys the science side of it. I mean, so much so that he brings it to the table, or he brings you to it. You know, I heard a couple of the cooks that ate there recently said that at one point in the meal, they ask you to stand up and they give you these special goggles and they take you down to the kitchen and they show, I can't remember exactly, I'm going to probably butcher it, but I think it was something to do with this class 5 laser that they do the vanilla bean with the wine glass. They take you down and they show you that happening, and then you go back and sit down and they serve you the course. I mean, that is science, and they're making an effort to show you that. Wiley, I think, probably not so much. You know, Heston Blumenthal at the Fat Duck is, you know, probably carries that label pretty strong too. So I don't know. You know, it's just.
You know, it's interesting about the laser thing. When I had spoken to Ben Roche, the pastry chef at Moto, about that, and he said that one of the things, they had tried different ways to get that vanilla bean essence, and like burning it with the torch and traditional means, and there was a carbonization, and that was in the essence. And the only way that they and maybe they're just fleecing me, but maybe not, that the idea is that the laser was the only way to really get the pure vanilla smoke without any of the off flavors. And so, in that sense, it's still in service of flavor, you know, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, you know? Absolutely.
You know, people don't see that necessarily.
Right, right.
There's this other idea, the idea of cuisine as art and art as cuisine. And, you know, I know you would never say, oh, I'm an artist, or maybe you would, I don't know. But one of the things, you know, Mike, I interviewed Michael Rollman earlier this year, and one of the things he and I were talking about, what you were doing, and this idea that it probably becomes art when you redefine paradigms, and I think that's certainly what you're doing with a lot of the things you're doing. And when you start thinking about art, you know, art is many things, and you know, the two I think of, or one is, you know, it's a form of entertainment, and it's a form of enjoyment for people. the other side of art is that in some ways it's often a statement, or mm-hmm. you're trying to say something. And, you know, if you look at, like, postmodernism, you know, people would say that, you know, one of the themes is that you're reinforcing, you know, the alienation of mass production or right. things like that. You know, I know you're certainly trying to entertain people. I wonder if there's a sense of statement with what you're doing. Are you trying to convey anything to people other than hey, this is what food can be or it's enjoyable?
Not a deliberate statement, not a premeditated statement. Mm-hmm. I think that definitely entertainment, definitely an emotional, a very preconceived emotional focus, you know, and I think, you know, it's like these guys that are hanging in, you know, modern art museums all over the world. You and I walk through, you know, you have your favorite artists. You have the works that you see that move you in a certain way, whether it be music or whether it be paint or whatever the medium, photography. You're going to be drawn to a certain set, and I'm going to be drawn to a certain set. But the end result is somehow you emotionally connect. And, you know, like the pheasant with the burning leaves that we did last season, which you may or may not have had when you came in September.
I didn't, but I am aware of it.
You missed it by probably a week or two. You know, that, while it's a good bite of food, is about something emotional. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, we're trying to get people, I'm trying to provide to everybody that came in and sampled that dish the same thing that I get from it when I smell the leaves burning, which is an amazing swirl of emotions based off of smell memory, you know? And so that part of it, while it might not be as concocted and deliberate in the sense of when I plan an entire menu, I'm saying this is the statement that I'm going to make, I think that dish in itself makes a very strong statement as to kind of the philosophy of the restaurant, you know? And you know, Michael and I had the argument, you know, because he was always standing on the side of craftsmen, you know? Mm-hmm. And so we spent a lot of time together when the Alinea first opened, and, you know, we were going back and forth, and he ate a couple meals here, and I was like, come on, like, you gotta admit, like, there is an element, a strong element of art in this. And he was like, yeah, you know. He was hesitant. He didn't really want to admit it, but I think maybe I swayed him at the end.
I think you did, because when I talked to him in March or April of this year, you know, he said, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and so I think you got to him. Two books,
right.
A lot of time together.
Exactly. So.
Smell memory. I think a lot of smell memory is childhood, mm-hmm. you know, what it was we grew up with, or, you know, even when we were, you know, the fall came like it is now, and
right.
the leaves are falling off the trees, and there's kind of that smokiness in the air, and I'm expecting my first kid in March,
uh-huh.
and as somebody who loves food, you start to think about, you know, well, what's their food life going to be like, because, you know, I didn't grow up in a family, you know, we ate well, and my parents, you know, my dad kind of liked wine, but I didn't really get into it until, like, you know, my early 20s.
Uh-huh.
And maybe it's not important. I mean, I think the first thing that I've thought about is you want your kids to do whatever they want to do as long as, you know, they don't get hurt and they feel happy about what they're doing. But at the same time, there's some importance if it's only the politics of the plate and good seasonal local produce and things
yep.
like that. I know you have a couple of kids.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how you approach that with your kids, and you know, are they eating this food, and what do they think about it, and you know, how do you approach that as a parent?
Well, my four-year-old's eating here. Well, he's five now. He just turned five, but when he was four, a little bit over four, he had dinner here, and you know, he tried everything, and he certainly wasn't afraid to tell me what he didn't like.
Yeah.
but, you know, they both have really, they're really open-minded for their age. And I think that's because we exposed them to, you know, really honest food when they were very, very young. He just celebrated his fifth birthday last week. And when I asked him where he wanted to have his birthday party, of course he said Chuck E. Cheese. But then when I said, where do you want to have your birthday dinner, he said, I want Thai food.
Mm.
This is a five-year-old, you know, so we took him to a Thai restaurant and he loved it. So, you know, yeah, there's they eat their share of junk food.
Mm-hmm.
They're kids,
mm-hmm.
you know. I don't want to deny them that, but at the same time, I think, you know, we really push them in a direction that they can appreciate, one, home-cooked meals, and two, just healthful, delicious, you know, food. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it'll be curious to see, you know, when they're my age, what it's like for them and their kids. You know, it's kind of scary in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, do you, so say they're 18 and in the same place you were, and they want to go to CIA, or, you know, is that something, you know, knowing everything you know about the industry and how hard you work, is that, you're okay with that? Or would you also go the same route your father did?
Well, I would, I mean, I think they're going to understand. I think they'll have for some reason I feel they're going to have a better understanding of what the industry is like being exposed to it for the next 13 to 15 years. But I'll still definitely pull them aside and say, look, you know, so this is a lot of work. However, you know, I'm surely glad that I did it. Mm-hmm. Even though I'm working 16, 17 hours a day, I couldn't see myself doing anything else. And, you know, geez, look at how it's turned out for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, it's certainly early days still. Anything could happen. But so far, you know, we've had a great run, and I feel like, you know, I made the right decision doing what I do. Mm-hmm. So, but I'll definitely tell them, this is what it is. It's a lot of work. But you know what? Again, if they have the drive, then it won't matter. Mm-hmm. If, you know, if they're going to go be a trader, they're going to work just as much, and, you know, it's under the same amount of stress. So what you do, what path you choose is almost irrelevant. What really, I think, is irrelevant and dictates happiness or not is more internal, you know. So.
Although sometimes as a trader, it's easy to get out earlier, right?
Yeah, I suppose. You can always just shut
her
down.
Your partner, Nick, would probably. Yeah.
But he, you know, he tells me stories, and I hear stories from his friend that, you know, basically in the heyday of his, you know, going, he was equally, if not more so, than I am right now. You know, they run pretty hard.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about like the 20 and 30 year cycles of food and that kind of thing, but it takes 20 or 30 years to get these big jumps. You know, food is something we, I guess, what do you eat to live, you know, although maybe I live to eat. Uh-huh. you know, it seems that it's one of the most important things we do. And, you know, what's your sense of why it takes so long to evolve cuisine the way it has? I mean, you know, it seems like cuisine, you know, it's like not everybody, I mean, a lot of people have heart disease and those things. But, you know, the kind of rapid advances we've made with cancer or heart research and, you know, probably pale, make food evolution pale, you know,
it's going to change.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you see it now where it's starting to catch up to everything else. And a lot of it has to do with just awareness. You know, I mean, the whole phenomenon of the celebrity chef, as Michael Ruhman talked about in his last book, and this is all a very recent thing, you know, and I think it's, you know, people can, like last night Wolfgang Puck had dinner here, right? And it's like, you look at the guy and you're like, you know, I just flew back from New York, and as I'm walking through the airport, you see the Puck cafes and all the airports and stuff like that. And one side of you is just like, oh, geez, like, you know, whatever. But then, if you really look and you really do your homework, like, early 80s, that guy was, like, rocking it out in L.A. Like, he was high-end, changing the landscape of food on the highest level. And then he goes to TV, and guys like Emeril go to TV, and they bring a large public awareness to high-end cooking. And what does it do? Well, it makes a lot of people at home take notice. And while maybe they're entertained by these guys on TV, then they go back to the TV Food Network website and pull a recipe off of there that Emeril created. And that's probably far better than going to the grocery store and getting a frozen entree.
Right.
You know, so...
Hot pocket.
Right, a hot pocket. So, you know, I think just now we're starting to see the takeoff of a greater sense of awareness. I think you're going to see kind of, you know, it's equally fighting with convenience, which is always going to be a problem, you know, in today's high-paced, you know, fevered pitch of a world, that it's really easy for people just to go grab some fast food. But at the same time, I think now we're starting to meet that head-on with an awareness of what is good and what is healthy and some more sustainable issues and that sort of thing. So I think it'll catch up.
I think that's interesting because, you know, you just did this thing in Gourmet where you contributed this recipe as part of their, well, here's how you can cook, like, a, you know, I don't know, you know, you don't need to call yourself anything. Whatever,
right.
The way you cook,
right.
They did an article and, you know, they said, give us some recipes to do that. There were like four or five guys, Omar and Jose Andres, I think. And, you know, there was a thing in the New York Times where you did like a corn salad
right.
kind of thing. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking about, you know, do you have any conflict over that? Because most people aren't even figuring out what fresh produce is yet,
right.
you know? And it's like,
right.
so yeah, you know, there's like me maybe who I love to cook and I'm interested, and that's like, yeah, how can I do some sous vide in the kitchen? But,
right.
you know, it seems that there might be a conflict there a little bit, or, you know, because we should
right.
be advocating for, you know, fresh greens.
Exactly.
You know?
Well, but I think they go hand in hand, because by elevating that awareness, by people looking at, you know, me doing these funky sauce blankets and all this and that, I think that'll in turn, the trickle down will be the farm fresh stuff, the, you know, the high end produce or things that aren't frozen and stuff like that. I think it all trickles down. I think it'll be fine. Yeah.
You know, you're always about the future, and you know, everybody has talked about what you do. You're always changing your dishes, but you know, what's your long-term vision? I mean, you're not a guy who operates on the day to day, I guess.
Right.
What do you see yourself doing? I mean, you know, is it going to be to make Alinea the best restaurant in the world for 30 years? You know, is it, you know, you talk about the puck thing, but it's like Michael Roman says in his book, you know, chefs will have a prêt-à-porter line, and, you know, but and that doesn't mean that you have to compromise, I guess.
Right.
You know, I know Thomas is doing his burgers in Bordeaux or
right.
whatever.
Right,
know?
Right.
Do you have any idea that you want to do something like that? Or?
Well, it's early days. I mean, I think you can close your eyes and think about where the next 10 years are going to be. That may or may not be true because sometimes it changes on a daily basis. But I think, you know, there'll be other things in the future, and we'll try to, you know, make them, whatever we do, whatever we touch, it's going to be equally as creative as what we're doing right now. It might be in a different genre, you know, it might be in a different approachability standpoint. Like, I would love to try to bring highly creative food to a more accessible level. Whatever it is, it'll still withhold the philosophy that we've created here with Alinea. I can't say specifically what that will be.
Sure. I know you compete against yourself, but are there people that you're really excited by who are cooking out there right now? You just don't even think about it.
No, you have to think about it. I mean, I think you're lying to yourself if you say that you don't, you know, kind of keep track of people. I mean, you know, of course, Ferran, you know, you can't. you just can't. I mean, it's unbelievable how hard they push and what they come up with and, you know, how well they do it. So you always got to, you know, you always got to be excited about what's on his next season. And then, you know, more on Con Roca, you know. I hear a lot of great things about that restaurant and what they're doing over there. I've never been.
Where's that? I'm not familiar.
It's not too far away from El Bulli.
Okay.
Cellar of Con Roca. You know, and here on the stateside, you gotta pay attention to what Wiley's doing. He's super creative and really has a good sense of blending, I think, innovation with making it taste good and, you know, having that responsibility. And then, you know, right down the street, you gotta respect what Omar's doing. I mean, some people call it just too far and eating menus and this and that, but you gotta look at it from the creative standpoint and say, hey, you know, this guy's got a pretty great imagination and he knows how to put it down on the plate. So those are the guys that I continually look to and respect and glad that I can be kind of grouped in with and kind of forming this mass that keeps pushing food forward.
I like the irony of that you were the number one restaurant in the country, but he was on the cover
yeah,
of his menu.
Right. right.
Even in the Today Show piece, they showed that cover.
Right. I sent him an email the other day and kind of we had our little fun with each other, riffing on each other about that very thing. Yeah. So.
Last couple questions I always ask, because I'm always curious how different chefs respond. You know, the first is the quintessential last meal question. You know, it's your last meal. Where do you go with that?
Jeez. Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, I think more than what you're eating, I think in this particular case, it would be who you're with, you know.
Well, see, that's my next question.
Yeah, is it?
My next question is if you're throwing a dinner party, you could have anybody around, and it's not limited to people who are alive, you know, dead too. You know, who would you want to have, and why would you talk to them? So go back to the food.
The food, you know, I could go highbrow or I could go lowbrow. Probably one of the all-time, well, the oysters and pearls. Mm-hmm. I mean, every time I have that dish, I'm just like, this is ridiculously good. And then just some homemade pasta, homemade tagliatelle with butter and shaved white truffles. Mm-hmm. I mean, that I could eat that all day long.
Is that you would homemade make that?
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Love pizza. Yeah. So anytime that there would be really good pizza, I'd be all for that.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with pizza.
And then as far as people go, geez, you know, it's almost endless.
Yeah.
It'd be really fascinating to get a bunch of cooks in the room. It'd be neat to have, like, you know, Ferran sitting next to Escoffier, you know, and be a fly on the wall for that whole scene. And then there's people that I'm close to now that I just never have time to see that I would really appreciate, like Thomas. I mean, you know, we have a great relationship, but we're both so busy I never get to talk to him. So it'd be nice to spend some time with him.
What would you want to say to Escoffier? Because obviously you haven't had a chance to talk to him yet.
Right. Well, I think, and I mentioned this in a Food and Wine piece. I don't know if they printed it or not, but I wonder if he was viewed 100 years ago like Ferran's being viewed now.
Right.
You know, I wonder what his peers thought of him then, and I would like to hear that from him. That'd be pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are there non-obvious food people, like, you know, like outside of food, or?
What do you mean?
That you would want to have it at a moment like that to talk with in a dinner party setting?
Yeah, I mean, there's always, you know, there's artists and people that I respect. Let's see, like, you know, John Lennon and, you know, a lot of musical people, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah. For some reason, I really enjoy music, and I can't say that my spectrum is very broad, but I would really like to talk to him.
What do you like about John Lennon?
Well, it's just, you know, it's just a very emotional, visionary type of passionate person that I think I would really enjoy hearing his thoughts on things.
Thank you for doing this.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the interview. As always, drop me a line at mjnagran@hungrymag.com if you have feedback. And we'll see you soon. And in the meantime, stay hungry.
Three, two.